Accession number 26731, Reel 2.
Leonard Vincent Knowles, Reel 2.
We had servicing Tempests, the Fight Squadron, Wellingtons of the Transport Section, Ansons, and when the Wellingtons were scrapped, we had Dakotas. And there are also aircraft coming through in transit. Every now and again, something would come through on its way to Singapore, for instance. When the Singapore emergency started, they had great problems in Singapore with rioting and so forth. And we had this aircraft, this Lancaster came in on its way to Singapore and had this engine fault. So they had to send back to the UK for spare engine for it. And we were told that in no event were the local Arabs to get anywhere near this Lancaster. And we couldn't understand why. But someone finally got to look inside there, and the whole aircraft was loaded then with tear gas grenades for riot control in Singapore. We had, it was 8 Squadron, the Tempest Squadron, was an active service unit. Inasmuch
that was your squadron?
Well, I was station headquarters, but most of my work was concerned with 8 Squadron because we didn't have enough wireless fitters to go round. Station headquarters should have had their own section, 8 Squadron should have had their own section, and the transport people, but there were just two or three of us, and we had to do the lot. And I consider myself more or less semi-detached to 8 Squadron. As I say, they were an active service unit in as much as they were used in controlling the Aden Protectorate. Various tribes, various sheikhs and so forth would step out of line, and where they didn't have enough troops to control them, they used to threaten them with the RAF. And while I was there, I suppose we had about 4 or 5 of these actions wherein they would warn them that if they didn't comply, if they didn't stop raiding caravans, if they didn't pay the taxes, then they would be attacked. And they used to give them 24 hours warning and then go in after with rockets and bombs. Seems pretty crude, but that's what happened.
Can you describe your job in a bit more detail and the structure of your, I would say organisation, but you know, you're a wireless fitter, mm-hmm. How many of you were there, what was the hierarchy within?
We had a signals officer, we had a sergeant, 2 corporals, all wireless fitters. There were three wireless fitters and a couple of radar fitters. Now, as you pointed out just now, we had a 10-month course for a 2-year service. Well, they decided that 10 months was too long a period to use up. So they brought in the category of, not wireless fitter, radio mechanic. Now, radio mechanic was a Group 2 trade, as opposed to a wireless fitter being a Group 1 trade. And the radio mechanic only took a 5-month course, and he only specialised in either ground or air radio, whereas as a fitter, I was supposed to specialise in ground station and airborne radio. Well, the usual thing of a morning was to do a daily inspection of the aircraft, and for that you used to use something called a trolleyak, which was a huge battery mounted on wheels, which you used to plug into the aircraft. They were used for starting the engines, and they also used for if you're using the radio. You couldn't use the radio on the aircraft battery because you run the thing down. We had 2 Arab labourers who were employed to pull these trolleyaks around for us. So we would have go through the daily inspections on these aircraft. Anything wrong, you'd remove the wider set, take it back to the section, retune it, repair it, etc. But they were a devil to maintain, because they were partly mechanical as well as being electrical. And we couldn't get the spares. We couldn't get hold of a spare radio, a new radio, for love and the money. We had to keep spending a lot of time keeping these things in service. When that was done, you usually had what was known as a minor inspection on, in which case you would, if it's in the case of the Wellingtons or the Ansons, you stripped all the radio equipment out, brought it back to the section and serviced it. You'd have that on the go as well as your daily inspections. But the day started about 7 in the morning till 1 o'clock. And you had the afternoon off because of the heat. And the heat and the humidity were pretty deadly. So in the afternoon you could go swimming down at the local Neffy Lido inside the shark-proof fencing on the beach there.
What was your accommodation like? Where were you living?
Barrack blocks, quite clean, very warm, very hot. Bathroom, showers. The trick was taking a shower. You wanted the cold shower, you didn't want a warm one. The water was normally warm without any heating applied to it. And there used to be these two shower booths. And the trick was to start your shower in one booth and use up the cold water that was in the pipe between you and the tank on the roof, and then nip smartly into the next one and use that cold water up. That's how warm it was.
Were there any other special things that you did to cope with the climate?
Well, not really, no. That was it. You wore very little. It did get some, not necessarily scary, but it got quite exciting when the United Nations in their wisdom decided to partition Palestine. All over the Middle East, the Arabs showed their anger, and there was a couple of days of heavy rioting in Aden where over 100 people were killed. And that particular night, I was attending a party out at the transmitting station, which is out in the desert. And we were disturbed by an officer and a couple of men burst in on the party, armed with rifles, saying that telling us what the situation was, and they were going to commandeer our transport. So myself and this other airman had to walk right across the desert on our own back to the airfield. And it didn't dawn on us until the next day how potentially dangerous that was. When we got back to the airfield, everyone was being armed with rifles. The whole place was in a bit of an uproar. So we had a few beers and we presented ourselves at the guard room, stating where we'd been and what we'd done. And the sergeant took one look at the pair of us and said, "Well, I think you better go to bed." From there, I went on leave to Asmara in Eritrea for a week's leave. And I was also sent on detachment for a fortnight to a place called Hargeisa in what is now Somalia. The thing was, I was just an aircraftman first class, and the establishment for all the ape stations, they had about 6 ape stations going out from Aden, all across the southern shores of Arabia and East Africa. And the establishment was for a corporal wireless fitter, but they didn't have one. So I was sent out there to relieve that particular corporal. But I was there for 2 weeks. But in the meanwhile, another corporal had come back from one of the other ape stations and said he didn't want to stay in Aden, he'd want to go to another ape station. So he was sent out to relieve me. But that was pretty primitive out there.
Can you describe it?
Well, there was a couple of huts. We had diesel generators, very small flying control building, a runway that was just cut through the bush, no landing lights, just a radio beacon. It was used by the RAF and by as a sort of staging station. There was no aircraft actually kept there. It was also used by a local firm known as East African Airways. They were flying Anson aircraft between Nairobi, Aden, Mogadishu and so forth. And we had this one particular evening, we were due to go into the town of Hargeisa to the cinema. It was a whitewashed wall and a mud hut. And you took your own chairs and sat in the space in between. We were due to go to the cinema this particular evening, and when the radio operators picked up a message stating that this one of these East African Airways aircraft was coming into Hargeisa after dark. But of course, they had no landing lights. All we had was a series of paraffin flares. If you can imagine a watering can with a very long spout, with a wick going up the spout, and you lit the wick and filled the container with paraffin. And we took the lorry out and laid two lines of these flares on either side of the runway. The only trouble was, by the time you finished putting out the last flare, the first flare ran out of paraffin. So you had to go all the way around again. And while we were doing this, the word came through that this aircraft wasn't coming to our place at all. It was going on to Nairobi. So the wireless operator who got hold of this message was given a bit of a rocket because we'd all missed our cinema. During the laying of this flare path, what should happen but this Arab camel train walked its way across the centre of the airfield. So that could have been quite nasty. As I say, I was only there for the 2 weeks, but those 2 weeks were quite eventful.
How many people were living on the station?
On that station, there were just 10 to 12 of us. There was the officer. He was apparently sent there in some disgrace. And he was under orders from the CO to acquire a cheetah as a station mascot. We had a sergeant, there was an Indian Met officer, and there was about one of everything else, a wireless fitter, two wireless operators, a couple of engine fitters, a fireman, an airframe mechanic, and a driver. And that was it. Right out in the wild. And getting back to the cheetah, he managed to acquire this cheetah, and he was due, when the word came through that they found the corporal to replace me, on the aircraft that came out to relieve us, the station padre was aboard. So there's myself, the station padre, the corporal I had relieved, the flight lieutenant, and the cheetah on the Dakota. Well, unfortunately, when the aircraft started up, the cheetah broke loose. The officer had a length of chain around its neck, but the thing broke loose and started careering up and down the body of the Dakota. Well, the padre took one look at this and decided that perhaps the flight crew were in need of some spiritual guidance, so he took off and left us to it. But they managed to secure the cheetah, but unfortunately, when they got back when we got back to Aden, or RAF Cormac, as it was, the station commander who had ordered this beast, he was absent in Egypt, and the adjutant took one look at it and decided the best thing to do was shoot it, which is very unfortunate.
How long were you stationed in Aden and thereabouts?
Well, I arrived there in September, and I left the following July.
So that would have been September 47?
September 47, and it was July 48. I came back on the troop ship Dunera. When I got aboard the troop ship in Aden Harbour, I was greeted by four of the people I'd served with at Cranwell, who just, they were on their way back from Singapore.
How would you cope with being away? I presume that's the first time you've been abroad.
Well, it didn't worry me at all. I say it's a bit exciting at times, but at no time did you really feel scared. It's looking back on it, but didn't particularly enjoy it all that much at the time with the heat and so forth, but looking back on it, I don't think I would like to have missed it, as opposed to stopping home and not doing anything. I mean, a lot of people found that their national service was one big bore after the war. They did their 2 years, but it certainly wasn't boring. It was quite an experience.
So you returned home?
Yes. At Southampton Docks, just before we left Aden, word had come through about the Berlin airlift, and we were told that certain trades would be retained beyond their demob date, so that the people of our trade and demob group in Germany could be still utilised on the airlift. When we came home, most of the people of the troop ship were demobbed, and they gave us a bit of stick about that, as you can imagine, because we were just sent on leave. And after a 2 weeks embarkation leave, I was sent to RAF Upper Heyford in Oxfordshire, which was a parachute training station and also a service station for Dakotas, which were being used on the airlift. Well, there's about six or eight of us in this predicament, and they didn't really need us. We were virtually kicking our heels for 3 or 4 months there. What really annoyed us was not just the fact that we were in these extra 4 months, but around about October, November, the RAF in general were given the pay rise, which would have given us about another pound a week. But as we were due for demob in 6 weeks' time, they didn't give it to us. So that really was rubbing it in a bit. I was finally demobbed at the end of December, early January.
1940.
Coming into 1949 now.
Well, we've jumped a bit. You've arrived back home in July 48.
Yes.
You were up at Upper Heyford for the rest of...
My service, yes.
Yeah. What did you do during that time? And what role did you play in the Berlin airlift?
Well, at that time, very little. As I say, that there was they were servicing Dakotas that were come back from Germany to have their 50-hour or 100-hour inspections, but they'd already crewed that up, and they were a bit pushed to find us something useful to do. And I was given the job of section valve tester, radio valves, which just didn't occupy any time at all. And after that, I was given a job as out at the transmitting station, there's a transmitting station way away from the airfield. and it is that go there for a night duty, maintaining the transmitter, which was a bit of a doddle, really. You were sent out there, you were given a pack of rations, a certain amount of tea, sugar, milk, bread and butter, and you spent the whole night there on the camp bed, and you were making yourself cups of tea and range of toast, and you were playing patience, and it wasn't so very exacting at all.
So the idea was to make sure the transmitter was fully operational at all times?
That's it, yeah.
And so basically, as I understand it, planes had done 100 hours flying time would be come back to England for a full...
Well, whatever service.
Yes. You were involved in that process.
Not really, no. We should have been, but I didn't set foot on the aircraft there. I didn't get involved with the airlift until I got with them with flight refueling.
Right. So you were demobbed in 48.
Demobbed at the end of 48. It's either the end of December or the beginning of January. And I was sent on 2 months demob leave, 2 months pay. And the idea was that I went back to my apprenticeship with this contractor in Southampton. The law was that any employer had to re-engage you after your national service, unless this business was gone down the drain. There's also a scheme that was compulsory. There's also a scheme whereby the government would pay either a third or two-thirds of the money you would have been earning if you hadn't been called up as an electrical apprentice. Well, at that time, I was 20 years and 6 months. I presented these papers to my ex-employer, this electrical contractor. And as I say, that part of it wasn't compulsory. And he wouldn't take me on those terms. I could have gone back as an apprentice, earning the money I would have earned, which was £1.10 a week. 6 months short of my 21st birthday. I just couldn't handle that at all, so I just walked out on him. And then I was in a bit of a pickle because I was neither fish nor fowl. I wasn't a fully qualified electrician. I wasn't even an apprentice anymore. I couldn't join the union as a fully skilled electrician because I didn't have a job. And my brother recommended that I went to see the local ETU area officer. Now, whereby the contractor who wouldn't re-engage me was a local pillar of society, ex-mayor of Southampton, member of the Ratepayers' Party, or if you like, a Conservative, the chap, the ETU area officer, was an out-and-out communist, and he was more help to me than Mr. Corrie ever was. And he more or less bent the rules a bit to get me into the union, but I still had to find a job. But that's when the flight refueling job came up. Well, I went down there for an interview to Tarrant Rushton, and that didn't go too successfully. But a couple of days later, they sent me a letter saying that they were offering me this job in Germany, and I realised what the situation was out there, and was I willing to accept it? Well, I grasped it. I went down there, started working on the Monday, and I was staying in bed and breakfast in Bournemouth. And they were supplying transport from Bournemouth 8 to Tarrant Rushton, which was near Blandford. Second morning at work, they called me into the office and said, have you got a passport? I said, no, I haven't. Right, they said, we've arranged for you to have your photograph taken in Wimborne. We want you to go home, get your birth certificate, go to the local labour exchange, fill out the application for a passport, but don't leave it there. Bring it back here with your birth certificate. Well, when I got home, we couldn't find the birth certificate. So I said to my mother, well, could you go along to the registrar office tomorrow, get a copy of the birth certificate and send it on? Well, I go back. The parent rushed in on the Wednesday morning. And I told him what had happened. That won't do at all. That won't do at all. We've got a motorcycle courier standing by to go up to the Foreign Office to get this passport for you. So they phoned the registrar office in Southampton and alerted them to the situation. Of course, when my mother rolled up at the registrar office, she was completely nonplussed by this, the fact that they knew exactly what she was after. Well, the short of it was that the courier picked up the birth certificate, took it up to the Foreign Office, and Thursday morning I was given this passport. It was all that done that quickly, and Thursday afternoon I was in Germany.
And how did you get to Germany? Was it a civilian flight or a RAF flight?
It was a civilian flight, a charter flight. I forget which company it was. There were all sorts of little charter companies around at that time.
So what was the main business of Tarrant Rushton, your employer?
Flight Refueling Limited. Well, as the name implies.
Flight
Refueling Limited, yes.
Sorry.
That was their base. They had been carrying out all sorts of experiments for the Air Ministry with the technique of refueling aircraft in flight, which meant they had aircraft that were converted into tankers more than anything else. And they were the ideal aircraft to take to Germany to supply Berlin with petrol and diesel oil. Well, when I arrived in Germany, they'd been out there for the best part of 6 months, so the organisation was well underway. We were billeted at a place called Bad Nindorf, which was bad, implying it was a spa town. And we had transport from Bad Nindorf into Wunsdorf, which was the RAF station in western Germany. The base was shared by our company, the Royal Air Force, British South American Airways, which was running Tudor aircraft, and all sorts of very small companies flying, as I say, Lancasters, Holtons, which was a development of the Halifax bomber, Liberator bombers, and I say quite a few York aircraft of the RAF. Well, we were there. It was the end of February when I arrived there. And I was still technically a member of the RAF. It gave me quite a boost because civilian airlift personnel, were able to eat in the sergeant's mess. So as I say, technically I was still AC-1 Knowles. I sat there and eating my lunch with the sergeants. When we worked the night shift, we ate in the aircrew mess. And there I sat amongst the squadron leaders and wing commanders eating my supper.
So what was your job exactly?
Well, servicing the radios again on the Lancaster aircraft. There were, I don't know, six or eight wireless fritters, I suppose. We worked some 12-hour shifts, day, night, about three on the shift. And there were two or three others in the workshop maintaining various items of equipment. They would keep a spare item of each radio part in the section. And if the aircraft came in and said that some such and such a set isn't working, we should take it out and replace it with one that they've serviced. So, and that was how the system worked.
Were you working alongside RAF personnel in this workshop?
No,
there were three radio fitters.
All civilians.
All civilians.
No, the RAF, ran the whole show, obviously. They were allocating parking spaces for the aircraft and flying slots as to when they could take off. Obviously, you couldn't go taking off willy-nilly when you felt like it.
So you're working 12-hour shifts?
12-hour shifts.
Day and night?
Day and night.
In rotation?
Mm-hmm. One day off a week.
And how many of these Lancasters were refueling?
We had a dozen altogether. We lost two. One crashed near Andover before I joined the company. And I think it was about seven of the aircrew were killed there. And another one crashed in the Russian zone of Germany about June of 49, I suppose that was. So we were running, I think it was 10 Lancasters and Lancastrians. A Lancastrian was a civil version of the Lancaster.